I don't believe Chris Pereira has been able to join yet. But we definitely have a quorum to start with him.
Yes, we do. All right, and we are recording.
Okay, then we will go ahead and we'll call the meeting to order. And Shay, I'll ask you to start by doing a roll call, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michael Dow. Jeggy.
Yes, yes.
Brian Kirkland.
I'm here.
Thank you. Eddie Cook.
I'm here.
Thank you. Gilbert Arantia.
I'm here.
Thank you. David Byers. Tim Romer. Proxy, Doug Lang.
Here.
Thank you. Lev Gornick. J.R. Sloan.
Here.
Thank you. Representative Jeff Winninger. Senator Rick Gray. Richard Stebnick. Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Shay. And welcome, everybody, to we'll call this our holiday edition. Appreciate everyone making themselves available regularly for these meetings to help move important projects forward in the state, and appreciate your diligence in that. We'll remind everyone that we do follow the public meeting law, and we do have a format to enable you to take comments. There is a link on the agenda to the public comment form. You can submit a comment there, and the team will disposition it. If there aren't any, I don't have any other announcements, we can go ahead and step into the first item on our agenda. So first thing up will be with regards our accepting our minutes from the last meeting with the recording representing those minutes. If there aren't any comments, we'll take a motion.
This is Brian. I move to accept the minutes as written.
Hey, this is Jiggy. I second it.
Thank you, Jiggy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you very much. First item up on the agenda, our Department of Child Safety is here not with an informational update, but with a change request. So we will turn things over to that team for the presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Yan Gao, and I am an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am joined here by members of the Department of Child Safety, who will introduce themselves after I provide a brief overview of the project. The department is in its final year of a multi-year project to replace its mainframe child welfare system, known as CHILS, with a robust SaaS solution named Guardian, in order to increase efficiency and service delivery and meet newly published federal comprehensive childware information system mandates. In the initial planning phase, DCS completed a feasibility study, cost-benefit analysis, the federal implementation advanced planning document, product and service roadmap, and related budget documents. By the end of 2017, Guardian deployed mobile applications and tablets for field staff and selected Microsoft Dynamics platform and additional solutions, including OnBase and DocuSign. In 2018, DCS onboarded the primary technical integrator with the target dates of building and deploying Release 1.0 in July of 2020 and Release 1.1 in November of 2020. The first release was delayed by a month due to security-related redevelopment and the impacts of COVID-19. A second delay occurred due to critical issues related to data migration and the continued impacts of COVID-19. And release 1.0 was moved to February of 2021. As a result of these delays, DCS is requesting to extend the project end date from December 30th, 2020 to June 31st, 2021, and remove version 1.1 from the project scope in order to stay within the project budget. DCS has confirmed release 1.0 has all required functionality to eliminate dependencies on the legacy system and meet the new federal child welfare system mandates. DCS plans to reevaluate business needs and complete delivery of 1.1 in subsequent releases with FTE IT staff and their operating budget. ADOA Asset has not evaluated the release 1.1 plan and plans to continue discussion with the department in adherence to the PIDGE process. At this time, I will turn over to the department to introduce themselves, present the change request, and answer any questions you may have. Linda, if you're speaking, I think you might be on mute.
Sorry. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Linda Roberts. I am the program sponsor for Guardian and the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Child Safety. As Jan had indicated, we are T-minus 50 days to our launch and go live. And I'm proud to give you an informational update as well as information around our change request to extend the date. Next slide, please. So our overall project health is yellow. Our current schedule is yellow as we have rebaselined the program internally in September. And as soon as we get our approval, we expect to move our schedule to green. Our scope, as Jan had indicated, our MVP functionality, so our first three priority of the requirements, everything required to decommission Childs, everything required for the new federal guidelines called CWIS, and everything required for all the approved required for business needs to support the ecosystem of child welfare, some of the things that Childs never could provide, all of that is included in the 1.0 scope release. What is what has been descoped and what we are asking approval for descope is requirements set at what's called priority 4. These were wants of the business, and other items that are supported, like the federal requirements, are not quite there yet, or we just need to reprioritize them within our agency and to determine what is next. Our program budget remains intact and green. As we are, as we've extended the program, we've de-scoped building functionality to remain within the program budget. Our risk, as you can imagine, the program is still experiencing some risk as we get closer and closer to go live, and centered around the data migration and cleansing. And I can speak to that a little bit, in the next, slides. And we currently have no, large issues, remaining for the program. Next slide. Some changes since our last update. So our dry run one, so this is the big test where we move almost 100 million records through from child's to guardian. So we completed that 100%, and it performed within the time frame we expected it to, which is really good news. Our second dry run is actually underway. So that started a little, we were able to bring that schedule up a little bit and start that next, sorry, that's Felix behind me. Say hi, Felix. He's awfully helpful. Our dry run, two started last Friday, and, it's almost, I want to say it's about 40% done, and we expect to see another time frame where it performs under 200 hours. So the more practices we get with total data migrations, the more confidence that we can have in our pipelines not failing. And then on those delta runs, to make sure we do a full data migration and then be able to do these delta migrations to keep our outage window small. So the more practice we can get in that, and the more that it's moving as expected, the better and the higher confidence we have as we approach our go live. Business process validation continues. So I can tell you that actually business process validation, I believe, ends today. We have small bugs that have come out of that, but business process validation, which is that end-to-end kind of cross-function, now that we have the child's data in there, we're validating all the coding is correct, all of that looks good. The reports design, so we have about 70 reports that we have done through Power BI and in our operational data store, so all of those designs are complete. And our business and technical cutover is underway. There's big plannings when you have such a big system to do that. So we've actually started our cutover meetings about 6 months ago, just really rehearsing and getting that done. We expect our production deployment to be finished by Christmas Day, which means all the pieces are there. It preps the environment to do that final data migration. So today we're just doing those data migrations in our test environments. The final is to get all of the production systems in place so we can do that final data migration. Again, 121 of the 148 business validations complete. I can tell you today they end. So we'll have all 148 business validations completed. Our data migration and replication, 95%. So today it is complete. And our data cleansing. So how do I say? And I've been pretty transparent about this in the past. Data cleansing, I don't think will ever be complete. So it will be done, but maybe not done. So one of the things that we know, like 25 years of legacy data didn't just happen. So, it's really important that, we're going to get the data as clean as we can, but it's important when we go live to make sure that we have these kinds of data pitfalls and these data teams set up at go live that can fix data and so forth as we go along. So we can catch a bunch of it, but there's some things that are just going to appear that we're going to miss. So the important thing is at go live, we have these kind of data war rooms, if you will, that are able to kind of fix and get those kind of data things updated, because sometimes maybe something in the pipeline moving the data from the source to Guardian just didn't go as expected in the final run. The other is training. So our training is underway. We have, I would say this was as of last week, 54% complete Every week we get more and more training done. And I want to say we tacked on another week of training for makeups and also to give one more round for our super users to give them more confidence and practice as we go live. And then we are on track for our reports completion for go live as well. Next slide. So for the change request, and as Jan and I had mentioned earlier, we have our guardian requirements were prioritized as following. Felix left, in case you're wondering. Required for, so all of the requirements, and we have around 2,600 requirements in total, I want to say. I think it was 3,000, including the version 1.1. So there's all the requirements required to get Childs decommissioning. And if you remember, Childs was mainly just a case management system with some intake. So it has all of those requirements, everything required for CWIS compliance, which is the new federal federal rules. And then all of the requirements for the agency, since Guardian is more inclusive of the ecosystem. So there are needs with no workaround. And then priority four were requests and enhancements, which have a workaround. As stated before, our data migration and validation issues, along with COVID-19, just getting our teams mobile and understanding that, we had to delay the program, mainly because of the issues with the data migration and validation. Next slide, please. So our request number one is to change the end date from 12/31/20 to 6/30/21. 30 days has September, yes. The 6/30/21, and our new end date will be our go live for February 1st, as well as the planned decommissioning of child. So getting all of that done in the meantime, and then descoping version 1.1 from the program as the team has some requirements. So anytime you go live with a big system like this, we have, we have kind of stopped changes in child for the past year now. We have federal requirements that are coming. I believe there will be things just like in any big system. I believe that there will be items that the business will say, hey, I actually want it to kind of work this way. So we really want to be able to use our maintenance and operations team not to do just another release, like another 1.1, but truly prioritize what is required for the business. And it may be some things that we had requirements for 2 years ago just doesn't make sense. And again, where we thought the feds would be farther along, especially like in extended foster care and in other federal requirements, they're not, they're impacted as well. So, and for post go live, our program will continue to support post go live changes. We expect that first month after go live to really be about hot fixes and, hey, this wasn't quite working as I thought it would, that kind of thing, once everything gets rolled out in the field. And we will manage our sprints and future releases as priority in our maintenance and operation. Next slide, please. So our new timeline, no surprise, we've been doing data cleansing and data migration. And I just realized that that's red, and it should be. Like, data cleansing is awful and should always be represented as a red task. And our go live is February 1st. Next slide, please. Oh, and we are at the end. Any questions?
Yeah. Open up to the committee for questions.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Linda.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
The meeting materials included another document with an amendment that outlined some
budget changes. And I found that, I wonder if Linda could explain that document.
I'm sorry, can you pull up can someone pull up the document and reference? Or James, do you know what?
I don't recall the specific document, but anything within regards to budget, because we've realigned our budget to match with the delays in order for us to align with the milestones the vendors are still going to be hitting just later in the original plan.
Okay.
But we're still able to come in within our 86, 088, 076, a number I will remember for the rest of my life. So I believe that's what we were discussing. We just realigned it with the new schedule.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so we shouldn't have a budget ask. So I will say this is, you know, the next time that we are at ITAC, we will be about 2 weeks from go live, maybe 10 days, you know, I can't remember when the third week of the month or what day that falls on, but I just want to, you know, this is, we are so close. Like this is, we are near the finish line. Our pipelines are working. The data migration, that big final thing, it's, you know, we're in our final test. After 5.5 years, this is something to celebrate. What we have done, and with your support, we are transforming child welfare, and the states are watching, and we've done something really, really special. So I can't wait to launch it. God knows I can't wait to launch it. It's just like, you know, every day we're met with challenges, and to do this in the middle of a pandemic is just, you know, a testament to the team. And I appreciate everyone's support and would appreciate one final approval, I guess. So.
All right. And any other questions from the committee members?
Mr. Chairman, this is Stuart here late. Sorry for David Byers. Yeah, I got a question for Linda about that extra document of all of the features that have been omitted now as part of the de-scoping.
Sure.
If I could ask, who made those decisions to do the de-scoping of those particular items? And I noticed there's comments in there about, you know, this is just a want and that's not really needed and so forth. And I understand that things can change, but it seems a little bit, I don't want to say whimsical, but it seems sort of late in the game to be making that many omissions of things. So can you just give me a sense of what the business side of this looks like on the de-scoping?
Sure. So, all of the requirements and prioritization was done by the Guardian program team, which consists of a lot of our business, representation. Then this went to final steerco in our organization, which consists of our financial director, our assistant director of finance, of our practice, child welfare practice, our healthcare practice, our director, Mike Faust, and our deputy director, Shalom Jacobs. So they're the ones that did final approval on what to scope, what to leave in scope, and what to de-scope.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thanks, Stuart. Any other questions?
Linda, I have a question. So initial go live you were mentioning happens in February, if I'm not mm-hmm. mistaken. What are you, and I know you went through it, but high level, what's the net between what you're doing in go live and what's happening at project close end of June?
Well, so
I have the timeline right?
Yeah. So here's how I kind of, and I'm not, you know, so I really need to discuss the particulars with DES as well. So once we launched Guardian and we've made that switch, you know, all of our provider community, all of the agencies, everybody, we've determined that everything is operational within Guardian, right? We're not rolling back, we're forward fixing, everything's a go. The next few months or couple months, or if I had my way, it'd be like 2 hours, is really shutting off the access for the peripherals. So Childs and, if we remember at the beginning, it's not just the mainframe system. There's all these kind of little peripheral applications that kind of make that up, like our central registry. All of that functionality is now in Guardian. So it's I leave that access kind of a read only to make sure that everything, all of that documents and data transferred properly. And then, you know, nobody has access. And it's really that those last months is spent decommissioning and archiving that data. That's what we really expect. So once we validated everything's there, we want to start shutting and turning that stuff off, which DES will be immensely grateful to me, I'm sure.
So what is the risk in the last stretch, if you will, the last 3 months? Is it all around data?
It's all around the data. So it's making sure that I have a clear plan on the archive, right? I have a clear plan on the archive. I built the ODS properly that I can do these longitudinal reports that may not be available on February 1st, but the data collection has to be there, right? So that report can be produced when it's required, like in October. And so it's really around the data. You are correct.
So last question. If you run into a hiccup or something goes sideways in that last stretch, if you will, are you going to have to flow into operational budget and funding to wrap that up? I mean, is your budget pretty tight going through that month of June in terms of the project financials?
I would say yes. We'll spend every penny if that's what you're asking. So the good news is that I really don't have a, you know, beyond just the archiving. So once I've migrated all of the data as part of the Go Live project, it really is an archiving and decommissioning, like an unplug. So the risk is low that I'm going to find net new things. I'm not going to suddenly find a new system that I didn't know about. Well, I hope not. So it really is the virtual big unplug, right? So that's what we've spent the last 6 months is migrating, you know, 100 million records over. We have an ability to do that net new. It really is around the archiving and the archiving of the source control, and really returning that infrastructure back to DES.
Thank you.
Sure. Good question.
Okay. Any final questions from the committee? Okay. If there are none, I'll turn it back over to you, Yan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The Department of Child Safety is requesting to extend its project end date and remove delivering release 1.1 features from the project scope. ADOA Asset is recommending that the amendment be approved regarding the end date change and the scope change. However, the scope recommendation does not include evaluation or endorsement of the future development of the version 1.1 release. The recommendation includes the following standard condition. Should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the pitch to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA Asset and ITAC for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds.
Okay, any questions on those conditions and or what the approval request is?
Mr. Chairman, this is Stuart. Can I just clarify that that change in scope includes reduction in scope as well as increase in scope, or is it written intending only an increase in scope? I say that because of all those requirements that are getting excised.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is Chuck.
Yeah, go ahead.
For the record, so this change in scope is a de-scoping only. It is not an increase of scope.
In the condition, Chuck, is what I'm referring to.
Correct.
So, if they decrease the scope by 10% or more, even if everything else stays the same, they come back to ITAC.
Correct. So, if there was a change, either in de-scope or increase scope after today's reduction, then they would come back. So you have
okay.
That's listed out today. If that goes in either direction in the future, we will come back.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for clarifying that. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. Any other questions? If not, we'll entertain a motion with regard to the project.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Doug. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Brian. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. Linda, thank you. Congratulations on making it. continuing to survive, we certainly wish you and the project team well as you navigate the final months here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
All right. We will get the agenda back up. There we go. Okay. Looks like Department of Education will be up next.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Yang Gao, and I am an engagement manager with the Department of Administration. I am here joined by members of the Department of Education who will introduce themselves after I provide a brief overview of the project. In January 2020, the committee reviewed and approved phase one of a three-year project to replace the Arizona Department of Education's school finance payment system. As part of the approval conditions, ITAC required the department to return to the committee for review and approval of accelerating phase two and phase three of the project. On August 19, 2020, ITAC approved a limited scope of the accelerated plan referred to as phase one, part one, to address development and implementation of the must-have features in both the charter and charter and school district common requirements, with the goal of migrating away from the legacy payment system as soon as possible and reducing manual calculations. Today, the Department of Education is submitting a scope change request to include the remaining system functions identified in the accelerated plan, referred to as phase one, part two, to develop and implement the school district payment portion of the school finance payment system and to include requirement and development of priority 8 through 10 features. This revised scope has no significant impact to the project budget or end date. At this time, I will turn this over to the Department of Education to introduce themselves, present the change request, and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Yan. Can we move to the next slide, please? Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Whitney Marsh. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff at the Arizona Department of Education. I oversee school finance and IT in addition to providing oversight of data governance. I'm going to quickly run through who from the ADE team is on this call. I won't have them introduce themselves, but they will be available to answer any questions. We have Lyle Friesen. He's the Associate Superintendent of School Finance. He is our business owner, stakeholder. Satish Padasapu is the Chief Information Officer, the CIO. You've met him. He gives the monthly updates. Brito Augustine is our Chief Technology Officer, Kathy Beck, the IT Program Manager, and Nan Nesvig, the Senior IT Project Manager for this project. Next slide, please. Thank you. Yan gave a great background, still my vendor gave all the information, but just really quickly, I'll start with a project background. ADE is responsible for calculating about $6 billion per year in state aid funding to school districts and charter schools in Arizona based on multiple statutory formulas that are adjusted and changed most legislative sessions. The current business process for making these payments is built on a legacy technology platform that is a collection of web and desktop applications, spreadsheets, manual calculations, to process the various payment streams. The ultimate goal of the school finance payment system project is to streamline those various payment processes under a unified system that is automated, accurate, improves auditability, is transparent, and maintainable. Next slide, please. As Ian went over earlier, the current accelerated plan was reviewed in January 2020 by ITAC, and part one of phase one, part one was approved. In January, ITAC approved phase one of our original three-year plan, but requested that we return with a plan to escalate phase two and three of the project. If you recall, as part of that work that we did over the summer that we reported to you on in August, we identified the minimum viable product and escalated the must-have features to phase one to move off the legacy payment system as soon as possible. In August, ITAC reviewed and approved that accelerated plan, which takes the following approach this year. Phase one, part one, to be complete August through December, includes development of payments to charters, which we refer to as CHAR, and any common components used by both charters and district payment systems, and also included requirements gathering for school districts, which is referred to as APOR. Phase one, part two, which is what we're requesting approval for today, begins this month, December 2020, and goes through June 2021, and includes development of, it completes requirements gathering for APOR and development of payments to school districts. Phase one is $3 million total, and the entire plan is estimated at $9 million. At the end of phase one, part two, the legacy system will no longer be used to generate payments to school districts and charter schools. Next slide, please. So this is the most recent Project Health card for November 2020. We reported last month. You will see the overall Project Health is green. We are on schedule, meeting our milestones under the conditions, and do not have any current issues. We do have two risks identified. As far as budget is concerned, we are currently under budget, but encountered some hiccups along this first part of phase one in how we were reporting our financials and doing so in a way that was consistent with expectations. So specifically, we had been projecting and reporting on an accrual basis instead of cash flow. Our projections have been updated to reflect a cash flow for part two, so we anticipate that this will be green the next time we return. Next slide, please. The current focus of the project has been to modernize CHAR, which makes payments to charter schools only. There are, however, common components of both payment systems that we have developed concurrently during this time. In addition, during the last few months, we have gathered requirements for APOR. So how are we doing on our milestones for part one? I'll quickly walk through the snapshot of work to date. 32 of the 36 phase one, part one milestones of the accelerated plan have been completed to date. I think it's important to note here that based on the conditions of the pitch, a milestone is not considered complete until asset says it is. So when we're reporting on something being complete, it's gone through levels of review and sign off. ADEIT has completed 100% of char development and 90% of APOR phase one part one requirements. And we are on track to complete the requirements by December 22nd, next week. As I mentioned, the completed char development milestones and APOR requirements have been demoed and approved by the stakeholder, executive steering committee, and DOA asset. Next slide, please. This is the budget. To date, we have spent about $1.4 million of the $3 million appropriation. Our November and December estimates are just under $350,000, and we are forecasting to spend $1.2 million more from the months of January through June. There is overlap in December for parts one and two, but we are still projecting a total spend of $3 million, which includes roughly $80,000 in contingency. Next slide, please. Here's the phase one part two timeline that runs from December of 2020 this month through June 2021 to July 1. You will see some of the development milestones began earlier this month. This is critical to ensure we can go live at the beginning of the new fiscal year, which begins July 1. Thank you. Next slide, please. So what ADE is requesting today is that based on our continued adherence to the ITAC conditions, we receive approval of phase one part two to complete the remaining APOR requirements and development of the must-have features of APOR. This will allow us to eliminate reliance on the legacy systems for the most critical payment streams that calculate over $6 billion in state aid to schools annually. Once ADE completes the scope of work, we will return to ITAC for a change request to add phase two scope. We expect to return by the end of this fiscal year. Next slide. Leaves questions.
All right, any questions from the committee members? Okay, but I have one, Whitney, which is, my question is, how critical is the timing of the July 1 go live from a business perspective? Is that like, you know, preferable because it's the start of a fiscal year, or is there a criticality that if that go live date is missed, is there a window that closes or a bigger business impact? Or, you know, because when I look at the timeline, I only see about a week or so ahead of that. So I'm just wondering, like, do we need to be looking at contingency leading up to that to ensure that, you know, if it is critical that you hit that date?
Thank you for asking that, Mr. Chair. It really is just it's the beginning of the fiscal year. We're going to start with the new payments for fiscal year 22. And if we weren't to make that July 1st, we would continue to use our legacy platforms, which, as you know, are at risk of failure, but we could continue to use them. I don't know if anyone from my team has anything else to add.
Mr. Chairman, this is Berta Edelstein.
Yeah.
Okay, Berta. All right, go ahead.
All right. So the July 1st is the beginning of the fiscal year, but actually the payment will be made on August 1st. That's the first time the payment will be run. So we really have 1 month, timeline wise, there is a contingency there. And like Whitney said, if, things slip, we can always make payments with the legacy system. Then we got to consider, migrating some of the data over from the legacy system into the new system. That needs to be in place.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Go ahead.
And I think Whitney might have touched on this in her presentation on the flexibility of the payment system. And my thought went to, is there any issues with to Prop 208 or future changes in statutes. Could you elaborate a little bit on one or both in the system and your process for future adoptability?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could give my, I could speak, but it's probably better just to go straight to Brito, Mr. Chair, if that's okay. Brito, do you want to talk about?
Yes, I can. Mr. Chairman, so the question was, what is the adaptability, or how can the system be made changes so any new legislation can be, the rules can be made? Is the right answer to that question?
Yep, that's the question.
Okay. All right. So... no, that's a great question. So that was a important piece of information that we took into account when building this new system. Basically, what we did was leveraged a rules engine-based calculations. So there is no code change per se from the how the payments are run. That is left alone. All we need to do is leverage the rules engine. Change the formulas, and of course, test it in our lower environments, make sure that the formulas are yielding the correct results. Once that is there, then we can push those formulas to the new other production environment. So it's architected that way with changes coming in mind.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from the committee on this? Okay, yeah, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The Department of Education is requesting that phase one project scope be expanded to include part two, requirement and development of school district payments and priority 8 through 10 features. ADOA Asset is recommending that the amendment be approved and maintains all previous item conditions put in place, such as conditions related to project milestone, project financials, and monthly ITAC informational update.
Okay, committee, any questions on the conditions? All right, then I will accept a motion with regard to the project.
I'll move approval with the conditions stated. This is Stuart.
Thank you, Stuart. Do we have a second?
I second.
I'm sorry, who seconded? Doug, thank you. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion unanimously carries. Whitney, thank you and team for the update. Congratulations on good progress. And we just certainly best wishes for continued success as you seek to get that system replacement in before anything goes sideways.
Thank you. Very much appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you. Next up, we have Department of Health Services.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Haley Greenberg. I'm an engagement manager with the Arizona Department of Administration. I am joined here today by members of the Arizona Department of Health Services who will introduce themselves now, followed by a brief overview of the project.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ken Komatsu, and I'm the state epidemiologist and office chief for infectious disease services with the department. And I'll serve as the program project lead, and I'll let Paula and Robbie introduce themselves.
Hi, this is Paula Mattingly. I'm the Chief Information Officer.
This is Ravi Pitti, Enterprise Architect.
And we also have Samir Halai, who's also the CEO and Chief Architect of the COVID Watch app and the implementation group. So let me go to the next slide, please.
Oh, one second, Ken.
Oh, go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, currently the Arizona Department of Health Services receives communicable disease reports for a number of different conditions and syndromes from healthcare providers, facilities, schools, and laboratories pursuant to Arizona Administrative Code Title 9, Chapter 6. These reports are received through a variety of methods, including fax, telephone, or manual entry. The proposed solution will expand on the state of Arizona's current COVID-19 contact tracing efforts. The contact tracing process in place has manual components and does not provide anonymous notification to potentially infected individuals in a timely manner. Additionally, ADHS would like to improve location accuracy of potentially infected users. ADHS has identified an opportunity to use newly available exposure notification technology to enhance and accelerate a key aspect of the state's existing COVID-19 contact tracing efforts. At this time, I will turn this over to Ken and the project team over at ADHS to present additional information regarding the proposed project and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Haley. May I have the next slide, please? So as she mentioned, you know, right now we have over 4,000 new patients or cases, we usually call them, reported each day in Arizona. And of course, trying to call all these patients, investigate each case, elicit their contacts, then contact them is really an overwhelming task. And it's really overwhelmed our capacity within the state. And that would be both state health department, county health departments, and tribal health departments. So a case is most infectious early on in the infection, so it's critical to contact a patient with a positive test as soon as possible so they can isolate and limit the spread for about 10 days. Delays in the reporting of those results or calling the case may result in spread, but also a poor recall for who those contacts are and where they have been in the past 14 days or since their symptom onset. So we must follow up on all those known contacts, ask them if they want to quarantine for 10 days and self-monitor them for symptoms so that they can, again, not spread the disease, as well as maybe get tested if they do begin to have symptoms. Next slide, please. So Apple and Google developed, as Haley mentioned, an exposure notification application program interface. We call it AGEN, or GN, where smartphones can anonymously detect the proximity of each other using a low-power Bluetooth technology, and it can record those contacts and anonymously notify others who have been in close contact or exposed the less than 60 or for 15 minutes. So some cases don't want to give the names of their exposed contacts or don't remember the name or the contact information of those they may have exposed. And for case investigation contact tracing, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the sooner the better. And in Switzerland, who does have an app that does this, showed an 8% reduction in cases and 6% reduction in deaths, estimated, with a 15% adoption rate using their own application. Next slide, please. So, we believe that the benefits of having this COVID Watch app is really it gives Arizona's a participatory role in helping to control this pandemic, which they really, other than the usual distancing, mask wearing, and hand washing, you know, this gives them yet another piece that's a more active role. And there's no cost to anyone to download this app other than the 12.3 megabytes on their phone, picking up that memory. So this could result in more timely intervention, allow one to anonymously, again, notify exposed contacts. It increases our capacity with the state, counties, and tribes to conduct contact tracing. And really, it applies public health informatics or the leveraging of technology to improve our public health practice. So, and this works for Arizona's traveling to other states using a similar Apple Google-enabled app. And it is being used in 21 other states currently, right now. And travelers from those states can also be notified within our state because it is compatible using that same API. Next slide, please. Because U of A was involved in its development, it incorporates a risk algorithm, which is unique to this app as opposed to any other app other than, I think Germany is now incorporating a risk algorithm into their app. So it's easily can be changed to make it either more sensitive or less sensitive based on the instance or prevalence of the disease in your area. So if it goes up in instance, you may want to tone down the sensitivity because it's notifying too many people versus when it's a low prevalence of disease or low incidence, you may want to increase that sensitivity just to be more conservative. It does have the ability to partition or regionalize the communities. And so that's where we have the University of Arizona and NAU as their own regions or communities so they can tailor it to their needs. And it has demonstrated success on the University of Arizona campus. Obviously, this is not representative of the whole state population, but no other app has really presented the data to support a successful application like this other than Switzerland. Next slide, please. So it is already available on the App Store as a pilot. And so it's fairly simple to just upload some changes to our version of the state of Arizona region to make it able to accept verification codes and to send notifications. Again, it is connected to the National Key Server, which is sponsored by the Association of Public Health Laboratories, so that it allows that interstate notification. And to verify a patient's positive test, it will also host a verification server so that when a patient decides to notify their contacts, they can access a code to notify those and put those into the system, because obviously we want to verify that a patient truly has a positive test and not just anyone. And then hopefully this will shorten the time to notification of contacts. We're working with some large clinical laboratories and a physician app as well to provide those codes right when they get their results. So we feel like that will shorten that time frame to notification if we can give them those verification codes as soon as they get the results, as opposed to calling the health department, waiting for that data feed to come in, maybe a day later, and then share those codes. So hopefully we can get these available on a portal for certain laboratories where they oftentimes a patient will go to a patient portal to get their results and then get the code as well. And this, of course, will work seamlessly alongside the manual contact tracing that must continue. So this is really a supplement to increase our capacity. Next slide, please. So I think I missed this slide. There we go. Could we go to the next slide, please? So our proposed solution, again, we did look at other applications. Early on, the governor provided the entitlement to the Department of Health Services for this app, for the Apple-Google exposure notification API. And then he asked the three state universities to coordinate together the use of this technology to make an app. And the University of Arizona took the lead, and they chose this COVID Watch app based on their research and the really unavailability of other commercial apps that could incorporate a risk algorithm at that time. And since that time, of course, there are many other apps. As I mentioned, there are 21 other states that have it available. And looking at some of those apps, none of them, again, incorporate that risk algorithm. So COVID Green was one of those. And that does not have that capability. It does not have that regional capability either. So if we wanted a tribe to be able to do, because their sovereign nations have their own risk algorithm or their own messaging, then that would not be possible with COVID Green. The other, since that time, Apple and Google have pushed out something called Ian Express, where just the OS on Apple phone can actually provide that notification capability. And the Android phones have a mini app that is downloadable. So, and those seem to work fine. Colorado seems to be doing a successful launch. They have over 1 million users, and they're able to notify 10,000 individuals by pushing out positive lab results directly to their phones. And so they get the codes delivered to them. Unfortunately, we don't have the infrastructure and support to do that here in the state of Arizona. I would have to hire many more individuals. As you know, there's a headcount process, and we really don't have the capacity to do all that. So that's why we were not able to select that as a method either. And it doesn't really have the messaging capability as well, and providing more links and more information to the consumer. Next slide, please. So the proposed solution, it obviously is on a Google Cloud. We have an internal dashboard that will be able to monitor some of the metrics and evaluate the uptake of the app, as well as if they opt to share more information with us anonymously, we can then see how many verifications, et cetera, are being done. So it is available on both platforms, the OS and the Google platforms. And again, the key server, which we already do have a contract signed with APHL to be able to share codes with the national key server. And again, we have been working with a couple major laboratories, as well as the physician app as well. Next slide, please. So these are our project responsibilities. As you can see, most of the heavy lifting falls on the vendor and contractor. They're hosting the website for the app and FAQs, which they're, if they have questions on the app when they download it, they can go there. Testing updates, they're providing all the for any new upgrades to the Apple or Android operating system. They're hosting the key server that connects to the national key server. They're also providing the verification codes off of their portal. And they're working with laboratories and physician apps to incorporate verification code provisioning. And then they will also provide training for those individuals to retrieve those codes. So we'll probably have to have our contact tracers also provide codes. And so we have several hundred contact tracers, and so we'll have some of that training provided by the contractor as well. Thank you. Next slide, please. This is our program structure. As you can see, we have the leadership team. We are in a health emergency operation center as well. So we have a incident command system that we follow. And so we have our leadership team. We have our program sponsor, Jessica Rigler, who's our policy advisor as well. And I am the program manager over seeing the project along with our IT support. Next slide, please. Here's our project timeline. As you can see, it's pretty short on the approvals, kickoff, and initial tasks. Again, because it is already live on the App Store, it's just a matter of updating the current app, and we can go live very quickly. We do have additional enhancements we're considering, and that's why you see the extended through December of 21. In case there are other labs we need to put on or other apps. Obviously, CDC is changing their guidance constantly, and we're changing guidance constantly. So we'll have to be able to alter that risk algorithm, maybe change the guidelines for quarantine lengths and isolation lengths as well. Next slide, please. This is our summary of our project costs. You can see that it's about $2.1 million. And you can see there are $13,000 in P&O services, professional outside services. That's really for one of the first major commercial laboratories to onboard into their portal. They have a hosted portal. And that was the cost it would take to make it go live and provide those codes. The rest really goes to the COVID watch vendor, and then we have some contingency funds set aside, again, for those other enhancements in case there are other laboratories that need additional payments to onboard as well. Next slide, please. So this is what our success looks like. We assume that if we get at least a 15% adoption rate, that we'll have significant impact. Obviously, the higher the adoption rate, you saw on the university that they had at least 47% adoption, and they got a 12% reduction. So that's really amazing. So if we can get over 15%, that will make a big difference. We're also working a little bit with MITRE to look at different ways to evaluate these contact tracing apps. They're kind of heading a national initiative, so they're trying to see what other analytics can be pulled from Apple and Google anonymously so that we can, again, enhance our system. So again, hopefully we'll try to decrease that time from results to notifying contacts, and therefore increase the efficacy of stopping spread. And again, the role of the public participation, I think, can't be understated, because people are always asking how can they contribute to really stopping this disease. Next slide, please. So this is what we're requesting, that we receive approval for developing and expanding this framework of cooperation between the state and WeHealth to launch and maintain exposure notifications and public health communication using this WeHealth app platform. And this platform is an evidence-based risk model built on top of the exposure notification protocol and our leaders in the space. The end goal is to use the latest science to calibrate our pandemic response, to optimize for the best outcomes, avoiding unnecessary hardships while still slowing down the spread, and strategically focusing on the highest risk and have the most impact. I think that is our last slide. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions from the committee members?
I have a question. Obviously, you guys continue to roll out new tech and new apps in response to what's going on with the pandemic. Can you speak a little bit to just the overall strategy or how this integrates into some of the other things that you guys have already implemented?
I guess I'm not as familiar with the other strategies that you're talking about in terms of, are you talking about vaccine management or MedSys? I am actually the architect for MedSys when it was first initially rolled out in 2005 and 2006. So it certainly, I think, goes along with that. It's just trying to move public health practice a little more towards the physician side, as opposed to government always doing all the work and really having the electronic medical records and those pieces really start to do some of that work for us, because it is automated. It can have alerts. It's really trying to, again, leverage public health informatics to do public health practice down towards the physician level or patient level if we can. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry. Are you talking more specifically just COVID?
More specifically related to COVID.
So besides the vaccine management, most of what we're trying to do is speed the delivery of the data. And that's been critical to really keep our finger on the pulse of the incidence of the disease. So a lot of automated electronic lab reporting and different methods to allow that, leveraging the health information exchange and pulling data from that to, again, complete some of our information, because much of it, you see pretty much all of our data on our dashboards, and maintaining that is quite an undertaking just to have that quality control in place as it comes in and make it real time as possible. So that's where most of our focus has been, is in that data provisioning and visualization so that others can make decisions on it.
And I think just to add, automating processes that are somewhat manual and cumbersome, leveraging technology to be able to improve the data, to be able to improve the decision-making and the speed of that.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? I had a question.
Sure.
The key server that will be Arizona's key server. I saw that, I understand the way this technology works is there will be a key server for Arizona. I see that you will have it connected and exchanging information with the Public Health Laboratory's key server, which will facilitate then if people are traveling in and out of the state, right, that
exactly.
will work and that we're not, I'll say, siloed off to ourselves and missing opportunities to properly notify people. For Arizona's key server, where is that going to be placed, and who has stewardship of that?
So the WeHealth folks will be supporting that. And one reason why they're doing that, so they are mirroring the national server. The reason why they're having to do that is because they're also supporting the country of Bermuda, who has just deployed the app. And so the APHL server does not go out of country.
Okay. Last question.
Our vendors to Bermuda will also be notified, which is nice.
Okay. My last question is really, this is, I'll say, is not from a technology perspective, but, you talk about success looking like 15% adoption. How this is going to be presented to the public and, for lack of a better term, I'll say promoted, people encouraged, underscoring and educating them about, how can they participate in this program with assurance of their privacy? What kind of thoughts, and what sort of a program has been considered for how this is going to be presented to the citizens of Arizona or the residents of Arizona to encourage their participation?
Yes, that's a great question. We have some additional funds set aside to do marketing and feel that obviously this is critical for this particular success in terms of the adoption. So we have, there's a company that's already been used for University of Arizona and for NAU that we'll probably engage with. And they're also being engaged for Bermuda, and they're specialists in social media. And we believe that targeting those 20 to 44 year olds is really key because they're the higher adopters of this type of technology. So those are our plans. We also are working with the governor's office so that he can do a press release and announce its availability, as well as Apple and Google. They're willing to actually push information on it to all Arizonans. So you'll get a message from Apple and from Google. So we're trying just to align those up. One of the larger commercial laboratories that we've been working with is also willing to do some push and alerts to their folks as well. So there will be a multi-point approach, hopefully. But yes, I think that is key and it is critical to get that adoption level. We did ask questions of people who downloaded the app and chose the state region, and even though it's a pilot, it directed them towards a questionnaire. And in that questionnaire, we asked things like, would you keep it on the phone for a year? And 88% said they would. Would they notify others? 94% said they would. Would they be willing to isolate? 96%. Willing to quarantine? 90%. Who had privacy concerns? And 70% did not, meaning 15% did, and then sharing app with others said 83% they would share it with family members and friends. And if you look at those that had privacy concerns, even 80% of those would keep it on their phone for a year, which necessarily makes sense to me, but they said they would. And they 87% said they would notify others. And of course, these are early adopters and are really obviously looking to download an app. So that's not representative, but again, it was very positive results.
Were those stats and questionnaires largely contributed by adopters within the U of A?
It was statewide, actually.
Statewide? Okay.
There were a couple hundred from Maricopa County and some actually from other states. There's about 1,000, a little over 1,000 respondents.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right, Haley, back to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ASSET is recommending that the PIDG be approved with the following conditions. One, should development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the PIDG to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA ASSET and ITAC if required for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds. Two, mandatory monthly reporting on the project status is due to ADOA ASSET no later than the 15th of the month following the start of the project. Failure to comply with the timely project status reporting will affect the overall project health. The first status report for this project is due on January 15th, 2021. That is the end of the conditions.
Okay. Any questions on the conditions? All right. I will take a motion with regard to the project.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Doug. Do we have a second?
Yeah, this is Jaggy. I second.
Thank you, Jaggy. All those in favor of approval of the project?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Unanimously carries. Thank you, Kenneth and Health Services team.
Thank you.
Time today. Good luck with this.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Last item I think up on the agenda is Office of Economic Opportunity about the integrated data system development.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Haley Greenberg. I'm an engagement manager with the Arizona Department of Administration. I'm joined here by members of the Office of Economic Opportunity who will introduce themselves now, followed by a brief overview of the project.
Thanks, Haley. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. Thanks for taking the time to review our request to authorize this project, and also thank you for meeting with me today. So integrated data system development, I'm the only person, I believe, from the office today presenting. My name is Vignesh Sukumaran. I belong to the Office of Economic Opportunity. We use the acronym OEO, and which I'll continue using throughout the presentation. My title is Senior Database Administrator. I do more than database administration. I'm generally involved in data operations in my office, and it includes everything from procurement of software and systems, IT project management, and negotiating and executing data sharing agreements, doing data exchanges with partnering agencies, et cetera.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, with this project, the Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity will establish an integrated data system, or IDS, using data from community college education records, participant records from the Arizona Department of Economic Security and Department of Education, as well as wage records from the Unemployment Insurance Data Repository. To better understand and improve services, an IDS is needed to combine administrative data that focuses on education and workforce systems from various state agencies and educational institutions with the purpose of assessing the impact of those organizations on the lives of Arizonans over time. The IDS will be designed to be expandable so that the integration of data from additional sources can be completed over time. Future studies may entail include data about health, healthcare, incarceration, and other topics, allowing the state to have a broader view on how the state agencies actually intersect with and affect the lives of Arizonans. At this time, I will turn this over to Vignesh to present additional information regarding the proposed project and answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Next slide, please. I'm going to spend a little more time on the first and the second slide introducing the project. I'll start by reading the first part of the problem statement. To better understand and improve services, the state needs an integrated data system, IDS for short, to combine administrative data from various state agencies and education institutions for use by, and I have a list of roles and entities and various activities that those entities would be able to do using the IDS. So the idea is that agencies and education institutions collect data for program operations, what we refer to as administrative data. There's a wealth of information in this administrative data that is being collected on a day-to-day basis, and leveraging it for secondary purposes would yield all kinds of evidence that we can use for statistical purposes, program improvements, etc. So for example, under the unemployment insurance program, employers submit on a quarterly basis earnings data on their employees to DES. So we could leverage this data set, for example, to look at growth and decline in industries. And that's just one administrative data set. Much more is possible if you can actually link multiple administrative programs or data from multiple administrative programs, agencies, and institutions. And that's where the integrated data system comes into play. So for example, using unemployment insurance data again, if we were to combine at the person level earnings data from unemployment insurance with education records, for example, then you would be able to measure outcomes. So we could say things like, the entry-level median wage for people graduating from our public universities from this particular program year is this amount. We can also say 5 years from graduation, this is what their earnings are. We could also say they're attached to certain employers for a certain length of time. So many things are possible when we combine administrative data across programs. So a majority of the states, by last count, 30 plus states have such longitudinal data systems, IDSs, in use, varying levels of maturity. Arizona does not have one yet. And what we're hoping to do is establish one with this project. Washington, for example, is a state that people refer to when they want to use an example. It has arguably one of the best and most advanced IDSs. And when I say advanced, I don't mean technology. I mean the breadth and depth, the scope of the studies that can be carried out with the system and what they have been doing, especially with governance and data sharing with that system over a decade. So in 2011, there was a report that was published based on research, basically trying to answer the policymaking question, do we need to invest more into recruiting teachers or retaining teachers? So they came out with several different facts that were gleaned from deep study that was carried out. For example, 75% of the Washington teachers leave and do so for retirement. Math and science teachers, they found, do not leave at higher rates than teachers in other subject areas. So in order to carry this out, they had to link data from retirement, K-12, as well as unemployment insurance. And that's what is possible with an integrated data system. Next slide, please. So the proposed solution, of course, is to build an integrated data system, but it takes a lot to get to that point. First come the statutes. The laws that were passed in 2016 enable system implementation, the reference to the IDS in it is the State Workforce Evaluation Data System. It allows for data sharing, especially unemployment insurance data with post-secondary institutions and multiple state agencies. And it also instituted a governing body known as a Workforce Data Task Force. Members include OEO, representation from the regions, Department of Education, DES, and a representative from one of the 10 community college districts. And again, when it comes to data sharing, there are compelling federal and state laws. We've got partnership agreements, written agreement requirements in all of these laws that are being satisfied. So we spent a better part of this year hammering out those agreements with our legal counsel and also conducting multiple reviews with our partners. And the signature process is underway. The governing body, which meets very similar to ITAC using open meeting, adopted the first set of data governance policies on the 23rd of October. Design and architecture. This again was a multi-year effort, thanks to multiple parts of ASSET that came together and supported OEO. We had multiple engagements with industry partners, Amazon and Google as well, including the solution provider for the Virginia and Nevada longitudinal data systems. And this was very informative when we actually finalized what was the overall design and architecture for the system. We also borrowed from Arkansas an excellent identity management framework that protects privacy and makes data sharing safe. So when it comes to development, I've got to clarify, although it is mentioned in the last bullet item, the desired outcome, that when I mention phased development in this slide, what I'm saying is that we would like to establish the system in the first and future phases by acquiring or engaging with other post-secondary institutions. So for the first phase, like Haley mentioned, we're going to be using unemployment insurance data from OEO's archive, WIOA title programs from DES, Delta Education Program from ADE, and then education records from Maricopa and Pima, the two largest community college districts, to establish the system. So procurement, we used two statewide contract vehicles, SHI, to select SpringML, a company that implemented a similar IDS in the state of Utah. It was called the Gombe Project, Governor's Office of Management and Budget, the equivalent of our OSBB. They combined data from vocational rehabilitation, cash assistance, and a whole bunch of social service programs for a slightly different purpose for case management. In our purpose, it's primarily to engage in statistical activities for statistical purposes. And then we also use knowledge services to select an excellent cybersecurity company called Active Cyber. The company conducted MARS-E security control audits of both the Access and the DES systems, and they came highly recommended. And since the creation of this slide, we have made a few advances in our effort. We selected a project manager. He's a person who has been involved in software development for over 20 years, has experience in Arizona government, has also led large IT teams, development teams in the private industry. And he is engaged in agile and other kinds of methodologies for project management. He's going to be an excellent addition for this project. Next slide, please. So project responsibilities, we've got four entities here. OEO, which is going to be overseeing this project, funding the project, and also doing the user acceptance testing, and the five mentioned partner agencies, and OEO is part of that. We've got an excellent team in Pima Community College District that is going to be engaged in quality control. They're data scientists who've done deep data mining work, and they're going to be very useful when we actually get to that portion of the development. We've got Spring ML that we selected for system development and implementation. The technical project management will be done by that team, and they will be working very closely with our project manager to successfully execute this project. Active Cyber has 8-9 different activities that needs to be done to implement a robust risk management framework as part of the development process. As you can see, the incident response plan is going to require coordination among all four entities. System security architecture and design and continuous monitoring strategy is something that they will have to work hand in hand with SpringML to implement. There are some other things like security control assessments that they will have to work with SpringML, and this is where our project manager will come in and help to coordinate all of that. Next slide, please. So the project timeline, we ran the two procurement processes separately. So I've got some information from the proposal that was submitted from SpringML, and that is all in shades of blue at the top of the screen. They're going to be doing development in 2-week sprint cycles starting in January. And then at the bottom of the screen, you've got three rows in green, and all of those are activities that are going to be done by Active Cyber, and they propose doing it in month-long chunks. And one of the really important tasks over here is for our project manager and all of the teams to get together and to produce a master project schedule, because some of those activities between these two companies is going to be interwoven for success. Next slide, please. So project costs, I've got the development cost over there, $1.3 million, and then 4 years following that, the operational costs. And I've got both professional and outside services accounted for. Statistical end user software, this is absolutely necessary because we are proposing using a secure research platform where there is no data coming in or out, and it's a contained environment, a virtual enclave into which people who use the IDS for authorized projects can work on. So we will have to provide computing power, software, data, et cetera, in this enclave. And then the cloud services are also estimates, and they're all based on data volume that was provided to the vendor. Google helped us with determining what those costs would be based on similar projects that were done in the past. Next slide, please. So the source of the funding is going to be OEO's operations budget. And there are the operational costs listed over there, average per year for the following four fiscal years. And these are non-appropriated amounts, money. I don't have anything else to add to that slide. I think the next one is a Q&A.
All right, thank you, Vignesh. Does anyone have any questions for Vignesh on this project?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this is Stuart. I've got a pretty easy question.
Okay, go ahead, Stuart.
I actually dug into the PIDG on this one because I had so much difficulty understanding kind of what was happening from the presentation. I am disturbed by some things about the development approach, and actually sort of lack of development approach on page 9 of the PIDG. It says that Spring ML may determine that standard open source libraries could provide better outcomes than the native Google services. If necessary, they'll develop a custom solution for data matching. Later on the page, it says an estimate of that customization is too difficult to determine. So it feels to me like this is the old pre-project or pre-procurement PIDG that we used to use, like say, okay, we're going to aim this direction. If you approve us, we'll go out and get the scope of work, and then we'll come back to ITAC and we'll let you see the details of the procurement and what we're anticipating doing. But I think my understanding is that we're past that, and ITAC would be approving doing the work with this vagueness kind of out in front of us. So I'm interested in the project's discussion about how custom development is going to be minimized here.
Sure, yeah. So I first have to apologize for introducing that vagueness in there, but I'll try and clarify it as much as I can. So the heart of the whole process is data matching. Google has an excellent tool called Data Prep, and I think that is going to be involved in the evaluation, and I am confident that that tool is the one that is going to be used. One of the problems when it comes to data matching, when it involves large volumes of data, is that the end user has no idea of how well that data matching is done. So they have no way of determining how accurate that data matching is. So that accuracy can be measured during implementation time. And there is a very rich field of entity resolution with machine learning, rules-based matching, probabilistic matching. So what we've asked the company to do, and of course this company has done a lot of machine learning and AI work, so this is definitely in their wheelhouse, is to take, for example, several different ways of string comparators and also classification methods and evaluate them and figure out which is the best solution possible and stitch them together to produce the final data matching product. It is not possible for us to just pick something off the shelf simply because of the variation in the data from one state to another. So I thought someone was going to say something. So what I mean by that is we can't take a product, plug it in, and say it's doing its work. That's a black box, and we want to stay away from it. So we want to use proper evaluation techniques to stitch those things together, and that's what I mean by custom development, not writing code from scratch. There are plenty of libraries out there. We just have to determine whether we're going to use edit distance-based string comparison versus some other method of string comparison. There is a lot of probabilistic methods that need to be used simply because of the nature of our data. As an example, adult education does not specify or require its participants to provide social security numbers. So we will have to rely on names, which means we'll have to do string comparisons. Does that answer the question?
Mr. Chairman, this is it's a rare treat for an IT guy to have his eyes glaze over in a meeting with business people. Usually it's the other way around. I guess maybe what it comes down to is a notion of how close the Utah project resembles the Arizona project from a Spring ML kind of scope of work perspective. Can you speak to that at all? How closely those projects align yours with the Utah one that your development cost is based on?
Yeah, so I believe there are actually two projects that Spring ML is engaged in Utah, and both of them have to do with integrated data systems. The one that I referred to is using vocational rehabilitation and a bunch of social service programs, and they are matching at the person level records to produce an integrated data system at the other end. So it is, in that sense, almost identical to what we're trying to do over here. And in my conversations with Spring ML, they are confident that they will be able to use 100% Google services to accomplish every aspect of this project, whether it comes to data cleansing, data quality work, data cataloging, storage, exposing data for query and analysis, including data matching. And what I'm trying to do is challenging them, saying, I don't want to take your word for it. I want you to show me on paper that you're evaluating and implementing the right solution for this project.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and I'm going to try and ask a question. I think that maybe branches off of Stuart's a bit, which would be in terms of, you know, the financials that have been put forward, the project plan has been put forward. What is the, I guess, what's the assumption in terms of the Google components versus needing to assemble, you know, something else? And I don't know if you can characterize the, you know, I'll say, what is the risk to the project timeline and budget if, you know, if our assumptions are wrong? And really, I'm trying to scope that really around this data matching, you know, component to try and get to the heart, I think, of where Stuart's going, which I think I'm, at least it helped me understand the sort of what's the risk associated with one outcome versus the other based on the current assumptions.
So it, I think it boils down to level of effort. Are we going to boil the ocean by looking at every possible data matching technique? Or are we going to cherry pick a few of those because we profile the data and we think that is the best possible set of things that we need to evaluate? And I think it is within scope that we should be able to do maybe two or three string comparators for the preliminary step and a few classification methods. And all of these are libraries that are available in native Google tools, as well as open source libraries that are available that are widely used across the country. So I don't think it is going to add too much time. I think it is going to be part of the development, and it's expected for a system like this for them to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee members?
Mr. Chair, Thaddy.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused by the project, to be honest with you. I'm trying to figure out, is this a must-have for us, for the state, versus a nice-to-have? And I'm trying to figure out, you know, how many users are going to be taking advantage of this technology? Is it, you know, and then I'm reading through the pitch that this could be used for policymakers and the first potential application be the integration of the education and workforce programs that policymakers could use to make policy. I'm trying to figure out how many real users are going to take advantage of it. What is the problem we're trying to solve that's going to bring the taxpayers, you know, a tremendous amount of savings and solving some problem? I'll be honest with you, this project just doesn't sit well with me, you know, and trying to understand. I'm just looking for someone help me understand what is this, that this is so critical for us to move forward with this particular project. I mean, there's many projects that we've seen at this, with this committee that are mission critical. This doesn't reach that level to me. And I just having a hard time with this project right now.
Okay, thanks, Eddie. Vignesh?
Yeah. So I had mentioned earlier that a majority of the states, 30 plus states, have integrated data systems. The Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, has handed out $800 million over many years for such systems to be built. The Labor Department has also done it. The reason I mention all of this is because there is a real need for this kind of a system for process improvement, program improvement, measurements. And these are things that are being done today in a very ad hoc manner, and they don't really produce very good results. For example, the post-secondary institutions, 10 community college districts and the three universities have data sharing agreements with DES. Under those data sharing agreements, periodically they send a list of social security numbers over to DES. DES does a match with its wage data, sends all of that data back, and the Board of Regents coordinate all of this work and they produce an outcomes report. So what we're trying to do is centralize those kind of operations, and these ad hoc arrangements can be enhanced to produce a lot more that is needed today. There are a number of things, like, for example, Carl Perkins reporting. There are a number of fields that the community colleges leave empty. simply because they don't have a way to determine what industry a person who goes through their program is now employed in. So those are the kind of things that are really critical for the state and something that we're trying to solve, and which is the reason why the 2016 laws were passed after studying what other states have done. So I'll also add one more thing. In Utah, they passed more robust legislation, appropriated $1 million to set up an office that does similar work and creates an integrated data system for statistical purposes that would inform agencies and education institutions on the efficacy of their programs so they can make program improvements and just produce better outcomes for their citizens. So I understand that this is very abstract at the moment. I don't have examples to offer other than to point to what has been done in the state of Washington as an example. EDRC, Washington, if you could do a Google search, you would find a host of products that have come out of a similar longitudinal data system over a decade. And they demonstrate what can be done with the system.
Well, thank you for sharing that with me, but I'm not convinced, but thank you for making that attempt.
Any other questions from the committee?
I don't have a question for Vignesh, but I do want to comment on the direction that you're going with it, Eddie, just in general, because this is something we've been pushing different data initiatives separate of this project from a state perspective in at least the last 4 to 5 years in my time at the state. And I can say, it's been a challenge, right? In associating the right data initiative with the right ROI and the immediate return in investment in gaining the priority over other really big box items that are critical to the state has been an uphill battle. And I think the thing that I wanna call out is in order for any emerging technology to work, and when you're starting to get down the road of 5 years from now, 10 years from now, into the future, when you're talking about how's the state going to leverage AI, how's the state going to leverage machine learning, there's a certain level where we're going to have to step off the cliff. We're going to have to step off the ledge, and we're going to need to get our data in order, regardless of what the initiative is that it's associated with. And is it this initiative? Maybe the committee will decide, but the state overall is going to have to stop taking a stance of simply prioritizing this versus the Atlas project from DES, right, or the Guardian project, because some of them are going to provide immediate benefit, and some of them are just about the state cleaning up data that might be, you know, 20 years old, 10 years old in antiquated systems that simply aren't going to work with emerging technologies the way we need them to when we get there.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Doug. Any other questions from the committee?
Could I add one more thing, please, Mr. Chairperson?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so just wanted to also mention that our partnering agencies, ADE, DES, and the two largest community college districts are very enthusiastic about this project because they already have a number of needs that aren't met. Because they do not have access to data, access that is secure, and access that can provide them with high quality integrated data that they can use for all the different things that were listed in that first slide.
Okay.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, could I ask Rebecca's question for her?
Go ahead.
On in the page, I was just looking at the funding sources. So it's 2.1 million plus of other non-appropriated funds. So those are not legislated, and they're not federal funds, even though We just found out that the feds have been passing out money for this kind of work. If I could ask, what are the sources for that $2.1 million in the budget?
So it's the OEO Operations Fund, and there's a better description in the defining statutes. I think it's Title 41 that created the Office of Economic Opportunity. They're basically corporation commission taxes that fall into a bucket. And I have been told that this is money that does not follow economic downturns and upturns. It's basically a steady trickle of money that comes in, which we use for multiple projects, not just for OEO operations. And that's okay. The level of knowledge that I have as far as the finances go.
Stuart, I know they get some money through the competes fund. A lot of the money in OEO is drinking water financing funds, but they do get some other like pass through that would otherwise, I think, go to the general fund or elsewhere. But once it gets deposited into OEO's funds, it becomes a non-appropriated fund and it loses any sort of appropriation status. And that's kind of how it ends up on there. I thought that I'll stop there.
No, please.
No, I just thought, like, listening to this conversation, that it might be helpful if someone from the asset team go over the provisions that were included in this, in their recommendation, because it might get to, I also listening have some, and I'm not, you know, y'all know I'm not the IT person on this committee, in how the project will actually be developed. And I was trying to, like, my oversight thought was, well, what could we get going forward to feel better about that everything's going as it's been presented. So maybe it's a good opportunity now to get some feedback from Asset on that.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is Chuck. So just so we start out on the right direction, you're looking to understand kind of the milestones of how we're going to begin the measurement and tracking with it?
What I'm hearing is some concerns on the milestones, the tracking, the budget, and the scope. So what is Asset doing to help monitor this project, since it sounds like it carries with it a bit more risk, since the outcome is more nebulous than you said earlier, Childs or Atlas?
Sure. So from an oversight perspective, the agency and Asset AUA have been engaged for a number of years about the idea and the concept of the project. And then, as was explained through the presentation, that there was a side-by-side activity as the design of this went through, right? And AUA Asset was even involved in the primary RFP process, right? Through the oversight process, we've worked with them in the development of the PIDG to ensure those type of steps were taken, so we have an understanding of what their plan is, why they made their choice. As we roll out the project, should it be approved, oversight will have its standard oversight analyst involved as well as its engagement manager to be at the meetings where development reporting is taking place. There's a measurement starting out milestones that are established at this point that will be expanded on as they gain more information in one of their first phases, which is their solution and design phase, right? So the team that I work with, who've met here, Haley, as well as our oversight analyst, will be in those meetings, listening and understanding what their plan is, receive the plan itself, and then help implementing the additional milestones that will be tracked through. So one of the things I would recommend is, should the committee want to walk forward with this, well, we don't have the ITAC recommendation that'll be read off. We can certainly add one. We've done this in the past with projects that have risk. We can have monthly or quarterly updates and report outs to the committee, not only just from oversight Asset, but from the agency themselves to ensure you feel like you're informed of how the development's going, risks are identified appropriately ahead of time as much as possible, and then those mitigation factors are put in place. Does that help?
Ms. Chairman, this is Stuart. I think there's also a concern that a lot of these decisions are project manager driven. I'm not sure we know much about the project manager, so that would mean that, you know, a little tighter oversight might be warranted. I think I would even recommend that to keep it from running out of control on the development side, that maybe instead of the standard 10% or more, we might reduce that down to 5%, so that you're at like 100,000 increase for wiggle room before ITAC would have to be back on it again.
Okay.
This is my suggestion. If anybody bites on that.
That's good. Any other comments from the committee on that? Just, I'm going to check back with you, Eddie. Did any of the discussion from, say, you know, Doug, Rebecca, and Chuck there help address any of your concerns?
Well, I appreciate everyone's feedback, but again, I'm just not convinced about moving forward with the project yet. So, but I appreciate everyone's feedback.
Very good. All right. Any other final questions from the committee or discussion? Okay. Haley, back to you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, ASSET is recommending that the PIDGE be approved with the following standard conditions. One, should the development costs exceed the approved estimates by 10% or more, or should there be significant changes to the proposed technology scope of work or implementation schedule, the agency must amend the PIDGE to reflect the changes and submit it to ADOA ASSET and ITEC if required for review and approval prior to further expenditure of funds. Two, mandatory monthly reporting on the project status is due to ADOA ASSET no later than the 15th of the month following the start of the project. Failure to comply with timely project status reporting will affect the overall project health. The first status report for this project is due on February 15th, 2021. That is the end of the conditions.
All right. Thanks, Haley. All right. We had a proposal from Stuart about reducing the standard 10% to 5%, as well as I think there was also a suggestion around yeah, maybe some additional oversight involvement. Any discussion from the committee on those points, whether you wish to accept the conditions as proposed or modify them?
Chairman, have we ever had a project where we've modified the condition down to 5%?
I do not recall a case where we did that.
And Chairman, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Just a point of clarification for me to understand the role we're playing here.
Yep.
For budgeting decisions, prioritization of budget, and back to the original question of, is this the right thing to spend money on? Is that part of the role of this function? Because if this committee says no, that budget goes back to whatever budget pool was talked about a minute ago, and then somebody else decides what to work on, right? So I'm just kind of curious, are we reviewing that prioritization? It doesn't feel like that's our function.
No, I think I would agree in terms of the role of this committee is really in reviewing projects and we'll say ensuring the project is positioned for success, right? That the objectives that are laid out by the project would be achieved by demonstration of a disciplined project methodology, technology selection, and team approach to delivering the project. So, in terms of prioritizing $1 over another, I agree that is not the role of this committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Gilbert.
I was wondering if we could have another explanation from Chuck about what the normal oversight as described before. I think it was monthly. Can you go into a little bit more depth on that, Chuck?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, absolutely. So the minimum oversight process that you'll see and what you heard right off there is their status reporting the agency goes through and self-reporting. It's done on minimally on a monthly basis. this has always been done. What you're seeing is just the standard new condition being added into all the new approved projects going forward, so everybody's aware of the start date. But the actual process that takes place, again, it involves the two teams that support this committee, which is the engagement managers, as well as the oversight analysts. And what they do is, in projects like this, which we call an enhanced engagement effort, they actually go into the project meetings, the status meetings. So in this case, one or two asset individuals will be involved in listening to the updates from all members of the team as they walk through on a weekly basis. And the purpose behind that is to identify what's being done. Are we marching according to the timeline and the milestones that we expect? And as we identify risks and issues, it's to go out, reach out, talk to the individuals, and then also find out what can ADOA asset bring to bear to assist the agency, right, or to help bring solutions to bear, right? So it's oversight's not just the process of trying to put brakes on when we think something's going off the rails. It's to help in that identification of problems and help in the solutioning of those issues too. And that includes bringing things back to the committee. If change requests are required with ideas to deal with those things, mitigation plans and helping develop those. There's additional resources inside asset that are brought to projects from time to time that are at the disposal of the chairman, Mr. Sloan. But at a minimum, those are how it's going to start out, right? And as we dig into this project and get through that first couple major milestones, which is really the designing and planning, we're going to know more about if anything's needed to either bring more oversight or bring more resource solution to assist the agency. Does that help clear it up a little bit?
Yes, thank you. I think that, to me, that is satisfactory. I mean, I think if there's something that you are tracking and immediately report it to us or help whatever your normal process is, I mean, I believe, I know that this has been a little bit different than what we've heard about in the past, but I feel confident in the system that you have in place for catching something that you felt needed to have more discussion. So that's just how I feel.
And I would just add in, I failed to mention that ADOA Asset, right, is a 100-person organization, and the oversight team is not the only resource that's brought to bear. We are allowed to utilize any of our experts with inside asset to advise the oversight groups as they try to work with agencies to either provide assistance, provide guidance, explain things that we're not familiar with, to include projects like this that maybe just don't fit the norm of what we see.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion from the committee? We do need to, I guess, determine whether we want to modify the standard conditions.
Mr. Chairman, this is Stuart. I can back down on the 10% thing if you guys would add in a condition that a change in the data matching tool would trigger a return to ITAC for approval prior to any, you know, further development work going on.
Is that, I'm going to ask the question, you know, Vignesh, is that a clear enough item? In other words, would it be correct?
We're going to put Google in there.
If the data matching tool set as proposed or in the standard set from Google is not adequate, it's determined that something more is required, that then we would have a return. I'm trying to come up with what's the right language to put the parameters around this where it's clear to everyone whether we hit that trigger or not.
Yeah, I think as part of my reporting requirements, I could also include details about how the evaluation of the data matching product was done. And I just wanted to also mention that the open source environment, all of these tools that were produced in academia, like the SURF tool out of Stanford, those are going to be offering excellent solutions for us. So it's just going to be plug and play. There's not going to be too much code written. And I can produce a report that shows how the evaluation is done and how we adopted the final system and how it was implemented.
How does that sound, Stuart?
Yeah, I like that notion of, a condition being they return if the data matching product is deemed inadequate, maybe.
Any other discussion from the committee on that? You have consensus on that?
That makes sense.
Okay. All right.
I'm good with that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Gilbert. Okay, so if I try to summarize, we would we'll retain the standard 10% variance from a financial perspective. We will add the condition that if there is a if the current data or proposed data matching tool proves to be inadequate, that that would also cause a return. If we have consensus on that, I will entertain a motion with regard to the project.
Motion to approve with conditions.
Thank you, Doug. Do we have a second?
Yes, this is Jiggy.
Thank you, Jiggy.
Yes, sir.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
I oppose, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Eddie.
This is Stewart. I'll oppose.
Okay, so that leaves 3-2. Okay, we have a majority, and the motion will carry forward. Thank you all for your discussion. I think it was fruitful. I do appreciate the perspectives offered. Vignesh, you're approved to move forward on your project, and we look forward to hearing about the progress. So that will bring this one to a close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
All right, thanks everybody. That brings us to the end of our agenda for today. Next time we get together will be in January of 21. I think we're all ready to see 2020 come to a close. And I don't know if we have the date.
January 20th of 2021 is the current scheduled date.
There we go, January 20th. So you can go ahead and please mark that on your calendars, and we will look forward to speaking to you all then. Until then, have a great holiday. Wish you all a safe and happy new year.
Bye. Thanks, Chair. All right, thank you very much.
I was with you, Eddie.